story of the resurrection. Interesting. Jim alluded to this as he kind of opened the service, that what we celebrate today really is so much more than legend. It's so much more than just some tale. I love the portion of scripture that Annika and Claudia read this morning. The passage clearly says that these things are written so that you believe. Luke was a physician, but he was also an historian. He wrote these things down so that people would encounter Christ. He wrote it down for you and for I, so that we would know in our heart of hearts that it's much more than just some tale, some legend. This story has changed millions of lives. This story has the power to change lives and transform nations. And you're here because your life has been transformed by the grace and the person of Christ. And if you have not yet encountered Jesus, you are on your way. There's something stirring in your heart. Your trajectory seems to be pointing towards Him. You want more than what you're presently experiencing in life. The resurrection is far more than just stuff of legends. You know, when you read the entire New Testament, you'll have to face the centrality of the resurrection. I know many people have all sorts of questions, problems with Christianity or the existence of God. In fact, Maclean's magazine, how many of you have seen the cover of the Maclean's just recently just put out? Did Jesus Really Exist? Is the title of Maclean's magazine. And then it says this is a little caption. I find it quite humorous. The science is in. Research is casting doubt on the few things we thought we knew about Jesus. Our growing number of experts think He didn't exist at all. Oh, really? I should have consulted Maclean's magazine's list of experts before. It's true, many people have philosophical and scientific stumbling blocks around faith. But I believe that at the core of most arguments lie deep, untapped issues of personal pain that cause the greatest stumbling blocks to faith. In 1911, George Bernard Shaw was asked, "How are atheists produced?" And this is what he said. "In probably 9 cases out of 10, what happens is something like this. A beloved wife or husband or child or sweetheart is gnawed to death by cancer, stultified by epilepsy, stuck dumb and helpless by apoplexy, or strangled by croup or diphtheria, and the looker on, after praying vainly to God to refrain from such horrible and wanton cruelty, indignantly repudiates faith in the divine monster and becomes not merely indifferent and skeptical, but fiercely and actively hostile to religion." That's his explanation. I think he's partly right. But I find it very interesting that the one that he is praying to is called the divine monster. Oh, that God would give us the grace to attend to our pain and struggles honestly and with integrity. Lord, give us the grace to grieve well the losses that we have in our lives, because if we do not grieve them well, it can brew this toxicity in our hearts that has the power to bring demise to our faith. I think in light of these very real questions and doubts of faith, I can't help but keep coming back again to the centrality of the resurrection and how the suffering and the resurrection of Jesus really answers so many of our questions around pain and suffering in the world. John Stott put it this way in his book, The Cross of Christ. He says, "The fact of suffering undoubtedly constitutes the single greatest challenge to the Christian faith and has been in every generation. Its distribution and degree appear to be entirely random and therefore unfair. Sensitive spirits ask if it can possibly be reconciled with God's justice and love." And there it is. I think most people, like I said, don't have necessarily philosophical and scientific problems with the existence of God. What really they have the problem with is suffering, the problem of pain and suffering. This is one of the reasons why the cross is so central to our faith. It reminds us that God is a God who willingly suffered, who left the safe confines of heaven for earth, who showed us what God is like, a servant God who is in the business of laying down his life for his friends. A God who weeps, a God who suffers, who understands betrayal, loneliness, abandonment, and death. Just yesterday, Kenda and I were out doing some errands, and she heard the song. I wish I knew the title, but... And one of the lines is, and maybe some of you know it better than I do, we've been waiting for heaven. We're waiting, and it's not coming, but instead, I commit to walk through hell with you. Some statement like that. And really, that's the God that we serve. A God who walks through hell with us. Who faced death. Who went to the cross. Who became a servant on our behalf. I love how Tim Keller says it. We do not know the reason God allows suffering and evil to continue, or why it is so random. But now at least we know what the reason is not. It cannot be that he does not love us. It cannot be that he does not care. He is so committed to our ultimate happiness that he was willing to plunge into the greatest depths of suffering himself. He understands us. He has been there. He assures us that he has a plan to eventually wipe away every tear. And someone might say, but that's only half an answer to the question. Why, yes, but it is the half we need. It's the half that we need. This is why Good Friday and Easter are so pinnacle to our faith. Skeptics and doubters have many questions, but for me, so many of these questions can be addressed in the Jesus' death and resurrection. Like I said, it's not just a nice story. It's not just a legend. You know, as you read the resurrection account, we are invited to evaluate, we're invited to grapple, to question, to put these eyewitness accounts to the test. I find it very interesting that not only were the earlier disciples brave, but they traveled vast distances to tell their story to others. They risked their very lives. They were shipwrecked, robbed, beaten. They faced incredible opposition, all to proclaim with great vigor that Christ had been raised from the dead. All the disciples, in fact, laid down their lives for that belief. So they must have seen something. We all know that lies turn men into cowards, not heroes. Yet these men took the world by storm. Their passionate conviction of the resurrection took them to incredible lengths and meant everything. So within one short generation, the Christian message was spreading into Asia, Africa, and Europe at a tremendous rate. Historians today still scratch their heads. Skeptics scratch their heads and wonder, how did this movement spread so quickly? And they keep coming back to the same conclusion. They must have seen something. This movement was an unstoppable force. The gospel message spread rapidly through the world, and it was like a missile. And so for it to have spread so quickly, it had to have a launching pad. So what was the launching pad? Well, we're going to look at that this morning. I know some of you are sitting there and you're going, you know what, I don't need to know or grapple with kind of the truth of this. I don't need to spend time evaluating apologetically. And you, just like the hymn that we just sang, you ask me how I know he lives within my heart. And for many of you, that's enough. And that's awesome. And in many cases, it's enough for me as well. But chances are you have friends and colleagues and friends that are asking questions. So I think it's good for us to grapple and to know what we believe. It can only benefit our own hearts and the hearts of others. You know, a lot of people don't have a problem with God, but try bringing up the name Jesus in a crowd and you get a different response, don't you? In my ignorance, one time I went to an AA meeting with my dad. I think he was celebrating one of his cakes, 15-year cake or something, and impromptu he invited me to come and speak, come and share. And man, I went up there and I started talking about Jesus. And immediately, boy, it was like it was a lead balloon, man. It just did not land well. Higher power, fine, but don't talk about Jesus. To follow Jesus isn't politically correct these days, considering how misrepresented Jesus has been, particularly lately, and how off-base the current evangelical movement is. Evangelicalism sounds more like a political party than it does a movement. So for many, I understand, when you talk about Jesus, they make leaps, they make connections. Oh, you're one of those. And so I understand, many people write Jesus off, not because of the person, but because of what he's associated with. I have to say, it reminds me of Gandhi's statement, "I like your Christ, I do not like your Christians. Your Christians are so unlike your Christ." When I was in Jerusalem, I met rabbis that said the same thing. I wonder if the biggest stumbling block people have to faith today, it's not Jesus, it's just how he's represented. So many people want to know the difference between Jesus and every other self-proclaimed God. They want to know the difference between Jesus and Islam, Muhammad, Buddha, Judaism, Baha'i, Sikhism, and any other faith. And you've heard Oprah, she believes that every path leads to the same end. All spokes lead to the same hub. But is that true? What does the resurrection say? What does it contribute to that belief? Do all paths lead to the same God? I find it interesting that if people tried to worship Muhammad or Buddha, they would have been told not to worship. Those two would have said, "No, get up, do not worship me." It never happened with Jesus. After the resurrection, Jesus' disciples met him in Galilee, and Scripture said that when they saw Jesus, they worshiped him. And Jesus welcomed their worship. Matthew 28, "Then the 11 disciples left for Galilee, going to the mountainside where Jesus had told them to go. And when they saw him, they worshiped him, but some of them doubted." And I think the same thing goes for us. And probably in this congregation, in this group of people, we have two groups represented here. And probably a mix of both in each of us. There's a part of us that has encountered Christ and we come and we worship at his feet. And there's others that are doubting. And you need to know that you are okay wherever you are. It's interesting in that text, Jesus did not reprimand those that stood back and hesitated and doubted. He didn't. He didn't even address them. He just loved them all. Some were up close and worshiping and some were standing off and doubting. And Jesus, "Oh, you'll get there." And Jesus does the same for you and I. My hope through this morning is that each of us will take one step closer to Jesus. I find it interesting that these monotheistic Jews who believed God is one, they worshipped Jesus, the second person of the Trinity. And that should rouse our attention. Because the big deal about the resurrection is that if Jesus did rise from the dead and ascended to heaven, then it was a public vindication of Jesus' radical claims that he was the absolute revelation of God. That he was God. I don't know if you know this, but do you know that Christianity makes claims that can be investigated historically? It's a faith that's rooted in historical events. So let's look at some historical events. Let's look at the New Testament, not as a holy book, but let's look at it as a historical document written in the Greek, handed down to us from the first century, telling this remarkable story of Jesus. Historians today look at the Bible, the New Testament, as really good history. So let's look at it as really good history. Let's approach this text in the same way that we approach other ancient documents throughout history. You might be surprised to learn that when ancient historians approached New Testament documents with this attitude, majority of scholars accept the central facts undergirding the inference of the resurrection. We're not talking about just conservative scholars. We're talking about mainstream critical historian scholarship today. So let's look at a few facts. Facts number one. In every one of the Gospels, we see this fact mentioned. They all mention that Jesus was buried in a rich man's tomb, Joseph of Arimathea. And this was huge, because this would have been familiar, then the tomb would have been familiar to both non-Jew and Jew. All in that small community would have known Joseph of Arimathea and would have known where that tomb was. So then disciples, if they claimed of a resurrection, but meanwhile both non-Jew and Jew knew where that body was, well, there goes their argument. Paul draws from the same source, the book of Mark, the earliest source, in his passage in 1 Corinthians 15. He says, I pass on to you what the most important and what had also been passed on to me. So when was it passed on to Paul? About 36 AD. Paul encounters Jesus on the road to Damascus. Shortly thereafter, he goes to Jerusalem and he meets Peter and John, who both were eyewitnesses of Jesus' resurrection, and they pass on to him what they saw. So Paul, from eyewitness accounts, writes this down. He says this, he was buried and he was raised from the dead on the third day, just as the scripture said. He was seen by Peter and then by the 12. In fact, as he was in Jerusalem in that time, he would have talked to each of these people. He would have met them personally, heard their stories. After that, he was seen by more than 500 of his followers at one time, most whom are still alive, though some have died. Then he was seen by James and later by all the apostles. Pretty significant that they mention, every gospel account mentions that the tomb is in Joseph of Arimathea's grave, in his rented tomb, his tomb. It's a pretty significant claim. Who's Joseph of Arimathea? Well, Joseph was a Jewish man and a member of the Jewish High Council. You realize how significant that is. Think about how Jesus' followers were feeling about the Jews and the Pharisees at that time. They were the ones that were responsible for his death. So, naturally, not too favorable towards the Pharisees, the high council, the Jewish elite. So, do you think it would be probable that Christians would invent the idea that a member of their very inner court of the Jewish high council, the ones that condemned Jesus to death, would be the ones that would give him a grave? It seems to call into question this idea that the disciples were all making up this event as it went. We also see that there's no other competing burial stories floating around. If the burial story of Arimathea is a lie, we would expect to find other historical trace documents pointing to what actually happened to Jesus' corpse or some competing legend. But all sources, every one of them ascribed to Joseph of Arimathea, is the one who buried Jesus. Fact number two. Then there's this issue of the empty tomb. Every one of the Gospels mentioned the empty tomb. One of the signs that something has been tampered with is in historical documents is that when a story is full of embellishment, it usually means that something has been tampered with. But we don't see that in the Gospels. The Gospel accounts are, have you ever noticed it? Very simple. not a lot of pomp and ceremony. It's very simple, and it's just stating the truth, the facts. In contrast to that, you read the apocryphal books. They arose centuries after the appearance of the New Testament, and they contain all kinds of legendary accounts. I want to read the resurrection account out of the Gospel of Peter, which came out the second half of the second century after Jesus. And the resurrection story goes something like this. You tell me whether this has the ring of truth to it. The tomb was surrounded by a Roman guard, chief priests, Pharisees, and a huge crowd that came out to watch the tomb. Suddenly, in the middle of the night, a voice rings out from heaven, and the stone over the opening rolls back by itself, and two men descend from heaven and enter the grave, and then three gigantic men come out of the tomb with their heads reaching the clouds. And the final man, his head exceeded the clouds, in fact, reached the heavens. Then a cross came out of the tomb, and a voice from heaven asked, "Has thou preached to them that sleep?" And the cross answered, "Yea." How does that sound? That's how real legends look and sound. In comparison, the gospel accounts are simple and plain. And this sort of thing that grabs the attention of scholars and historians. Then there's this issue of the women being the first in the empty tomb. This is hugely significant. Why? How were women viewed in the first century? Their testimony was considered worthless by those in Palestine and in the first century. Yet they were the first ones discovering the empty tomb. Listen to the words of first century Jewish historian Josephus. Josephus illustrates the attitude that people would have had of a woman's testimony in this Jewish society. He says this, "Due to the levity, the fickleness, the temerity, the recklessness of their gender, women should not be allowed to serve as legal witnesses in a court of law." That was their view of women. Yet women were the first eyewitnesses of the account. So the fact that it was women whose testimony was regarded as worthless who are the chief witnesses to the fact of the empty tomb is best explained by the fact that they were in fact the ones who discovered the empty tomb and that the gospel writers simply recorded the account as faithful and true. For every one of the disciples, the men, they were like, "God, really? You had women be the first ones to the tomb? This isn't going to fly." They would have seen this as awkward, as embarrassing. But yet, they documented it. It only adds to their credibility. If the whole account is fabricated, why make women as the first eyewitnesses if you're trying to cover up a lie? Or make a credible, viable new religion? There's also this claim among the Jewish elite that the grave was empty. Even the Jewish elite believed that it was empty. Matthew 28:11-15, as the women were on their way, some of the guards went into the city and told the leading priest what had happened. A meeting with the elders was called, and they decided to give the soldiers a large bribe. And they told the soldiers this, "You must say Jesus' disciples came during the night while we were sleeping, and they stole his body." So even the Jewish elite knew that the grave was empty. As soon as the soldiers came and reported to them what happened, what did they do? Did they go to the grave and find a body? No. They went to the grave and found an empty tomb. Therefore, they came up with the lie that they came up with. Even the Jews were trying to explain it away to try to figure it out. By and far, most historians and skeptical historians and exegetes hold to the claims of the empty tomb. They can't get around it. Fact 3. On multiple occasions and under various circumstances, different individuals and groups experienced appearances of Jesus alive from the dead. We're given a list of people. The resurrected Jesus revealed himself to Peter, the 12, 500, and to James, Jesus' half-brother. The list of eyewitnesses to Jesus' resurrected body, which was quoted by Paul, were listed as a guarantee. People that Paul, like I said, had talked to when he was in Jerusalem. Any of these could have come forward, disagreed with their claims of the bodily resurrection, but they didn't. The appearance traditions in the Gospels provide multiple independent accounts of these appearances. Then there's this matter of James, Jesus' half-brother. We can see all through the Gospels that neither James nor his brothers believed in Jesus or followed him as the Messiah. They were all standing back, not just hesitating, but they were severe doubters. They were, in fact, not just doubting, they were against this idea that Jesus was the Messiah. There's no reason why the early church would generate fictitious stories concerning the family's unbelief in Jesus as the Messiah. There's no reason. But James and James's brothers and all his half-brothers of Jesus all became active followers of Jesus after the resurrection. James, in fact, rose to the position of sole leadership, apostle in the church in Jerusalem. In fact, Josephus says that James was martyred for his faith in AD 60. What would possess James to actually go to his death, turn from skeptic to devout follower, but for the fact that he had seen his resurrected Lord? Now think about it. Most of us have brothers. What would it take to convince you that your brother is God? So much so that you would be willing to die for that belief. Can there be any doubt that the reason for this remarkable transformation in James is because of Paul's words, he appeared to James? Even leading New Testament critics come to the same conclusion. It may be taken as historically certain that Peter and the disciples had experiences after Jesus' death where Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ. They had seen something. Something captivated them. Something so changed them and set them on a whole different trajectory that a movement began and was unstoppable. Final fact, Jesus had every reason, or the disciples had every reason not to believe. Think about the situation. Their leader was dead. The Jewish disciples had no belief in a dying, yet alone a rising Messiah. The Messiah was supposed to throw off the yoke of Rome, not suffer death. In fact, according to Deuteronomy 21, which says, a hanged person is cursed by God, Jesus' execution as a criminal showed Jesus to be a heretic, a person literally under the curse of God. That's what they believed. The crucifixion was a catastrophe beyond their wildest imagination. In fact, the cross showed in effect that the Pharisees were right all along and that they were following a heretic. This is looking through the situation through the eyes of a Jewish person. So the best the disciples could have come up with at this point in the game is preserve the tomb and maybe make a shrine so that they could go there on a regular basis and remember him. But in spite of this, despite all their Jewish presuppositions, the disciples were all willing to die for the belief that Jesus rose from the dead. Luke Johnson, a New Testament critic from Emory University, writes that some sort of powerful, transformative experience is required to generate the sort of movement early Christianity was. Because it points to the divinity of Jesus. That Jesus' claims to be one with God were in fact true. It points to that Jesus' claims to be the Messiah are right. It points to the sound philosophical evidence of the existence of God. That God is the one who raised Jesus from the dead. Remember when I was a pastor to university students in Regina, I was involved in a campus ministry, and there was a debate, a philosophical debate between their philosophy professor and a Christian apologist. And I'll never forget, this one man came up and he said, you know, there's no difference. He said, I believe that people can die. People have died and come back to life. It doesn't prove the existence of God. Something supernatural, something happened, but it doesn't make Jesus to be God just because he rose from the dead. I mean, he died again just like anybody else. And then that's where the apologist said, actually, that's the big difference. Jesus never went back to the grave. And you should have, he was so upset with this fact that Jesus not only rose from the dead 3 days later, but then never went to the grave. He conquered death. He conquered sin. I find this kind of stuff stimulating. It invigorates my faith. It find it so encouraging for me. But for those of us who follow Jesus, we don't just follow Jesus because of a bunch of facts. Some of this stuff, it probably informs you, right? Hopefully some of this encouraged you. You kind of went, oh man, yeah, that's really good. I never considered that. But it's not enough, is it, to really transform someone's heart. It's really only by God's grace that we can hear this kind of stuff and that you can pour through the Gospels and actually receive it by faith, and all of a sudden you experience the living Jesus. The truth in our minds needs to kind of make that 18-inch journey to our hearts, doesn't it? It really requires revelation. God's Spirit opening our minds and our hearts so that we can receive the truth and know Christ personally. I believe many of you have encountered Christ in this way and continue to encounter Him. We're going to move to the second part of the message after this next worship bit. So I'm going to invite the worship team to come up.